right. Perfect. I might just stick around. Well, my apologies for this was originally scheduled for July, I think, and I was on jury duty. And then last month I was out of the country. And so we're finally going to try to catch up with the topic of equipoise, which is really foundational to the research enterprise. I started the handout with a quote from Harry Beecher. A study is ethical or not at its inception. It does not become ethical because it succeeds in producing valuable data. Ends do not justify means. Some of you may recognize that name. He was an anesthesiologist at Mass General who was really a pioneer in research ethics. And he was the author of the study that we looked at, I think, at our second session, on which he pointed out, I think it was 22 studies that were clearly unethical. He showed the methodology and so on, and he took a lot of flack for that, and the researchers were not happy with his article. But anyway, it sort of opens the discussion. And looking at three of the principles of the AMA's medical ethics, a physician shall, while caring for a patient, regard responsibility to the patient as paramount. A physician shall continue to study, apply, and advance scientific knowledge. When conducting clinical investigations, the investigator should demonstrate the same concern and care for the welfare, safety, and comfort of the person involved as is required of a physician who is furnishing medical care to a patient independent of any clinical investigation. And I emphasize the appellations of physician and investigator, because all too often we conflate the two and we talk about the physician doing a study. And sure, it's a physician, but in that study, he or she is acting as an investigator and has an inherent conflict of interest, which we looked at several sessions ago. Now, basic to the underlying principles of research ethics is the null hypothesis, which you're all familiar with, a required part of any research saying that drug X will not produce effect Y, and you can never prove it. But the researcher attempts to prove that it's wrong. Then equipoise has been was originally conceptualized as a state of genuine uncertainty on the part of the clinical investigator regarding the therapeutic maintenance merits of each arm of a trial. However, a true null hypothesis is very difficult to achieve, especially in the mind of the investigator who has invested in this endeavor. So Ben Friedman in 1987 tried to modify that a little bit by defining clinical equipoise, as the requirement of equipoise is satisfied if there is genuine uncertainty within the expert medical community, not necessarily in the brain of the investigator, but generally in medicine. But even this remains difficult. And looking at this from a moralistic standpoint, equipoise requires that the investigator be conscientious, objective, intellectually honest, transparent. All those things are good and noble, but it's easy to get off that path when somebody is really committed to a research endeavor. And of course, the randomized controlled trial is the standard in trying to achieve this. But if equipoise truly exists, no participant in the RCT is knowingly given inferior treatment. Now, just in the last year or two, there have been several things written challenging, questioning the concept of equipoise. And I thought it would be of value for you folks to be aware that this discussion is going on in the literature, because who knows where it's going to go. The first was an essay in JAMA this past February outlining some threats to equipoise. The first, and probably the foremost, is the bias of the researcher. Because the authors say that the conduct of the study rather than the outcome should be most valued. And they raise the rhetorical question, is it acceptable to get any answer versus a specific answer? And then the investigator bias may enter by the way things are framed, by sampling bias, outcome bias, and so on. The second threat that they outline or articulate is called presentation bias, which I would call spin, because there's often pressure, especially from those funding the research, to report results, but this may lead to selective reporting or even interpreting data to arrive at conclusions not supported by the evidence. And the authors maintain, in fact, they cited a reference that looked back at, I forget how many, a couple hundred research articles, and felt that a third of them suffered from this problem, there was spin in the reporting of the data. And publication bias, because journals generally accept only studies with positive results. I think that's changing a bit. It seems to me that in the last few years there have been more reports of negative studies. Certainly there's been a lot of criticism of the editorial concept of just reporting the positive, but it's still a problem. Then they mentioned scientific fraud, which doesn't really need any further explanation, but they did cite in particular the 2005 article written by a Korean scientist who claimed to have created stem cells from human embryos, and it was fairly quickly debunked by his own university. Therefore, the quest for equipoise rests squarely on the shoulders of the investigator. Now, a challenge to equipoise appeared in the New England Journal this past year also, saying that the therapeutic orientation of research, which is focused on the individual patient, ignores the wider societal interests in evidence-based health policy, and particularly the issues of the policy of who pays for what and when, and how much evidence do you need before the insurance companies can pick it up and so on. Then they point out three different perspectives, that the physician looks at the individual patient, the FDA in its regulatory capacity looks at safety and efficacy, and the insurers look at medical necessity, all involved in the same enterprise of research, but having different perspectives on it. And then the author says there are five things to think about that make it very difficult to appeal to equipoise. First off, he cites the difficulty of the definition. And he says, are we talking about a 50-50 split? We ask the medical community 50-50. Or what about 99-1? Is that 1% still enough uncertainty to say that equipoise exists? And then they point out the inaccuracy, I guess is the best word, of reliance on expert opinion. Remember, bone marrow transplants for breast cancer, hormone replacement therapy, things that have been accepted by many experts and subsequently proven to be not as originally thought. Next is limitations of determining efficacy on the basis of surrogate outcomes. Is there really a causal relationship between the surrogate outcome and the outcome that you're really wanting to measure? And the high cost of new treatments, and he said we should be focusing on cost effectiveness in relation to insurance coverage. It's sort of hard to balance this, because he said that so many RCTs are terminated early because the results are moving in one direction, which makes good ethical sense, but at the same time it may mean that we end up with insufficient data to be sure. And he used the example of the new treatment for metastatic melanoma, which had phase one trials that really looked very, very good for those with a specific genotype for their melanoma. In fact, he pointed out a New York Times editorial that said there was not equipoise here. Everybody knew it was going to work. Why are we putting some subjects at risk? And the conclusions of this author were that equipoise is fundamentally flawed. To inform regulatory and coverage decisions, rigorous evaluation of new treatment must be pursued beyond the point at which physicians and informed patients would choose it over current standard treatment. And it goes on to say that RCTs are not always required. before new treatments are approved or covered. I said if there's compelling, usually mechanism-based rationale, there's evidence of a large effect in early trials, or if you have a well-understood outcome with limited interpatient variability, or the availability of valid, comparable, concurrent, or historical control groups, and the use of validated surrogate endpoints in uncontrolled trials. So he's raising the flag saying, we've worshipped equipoise too long. It's not really valid. We need to have some other mechanism. Well, Peter Ubel and associates from University of Pittsburgh came out with an interesting proposal in AJOB, the American Journal of Bioethics. And that journal has what they call, I forget what they call them now, but target articles. Then they ask 5 or 6 or 10 individuals to respond to that. And so Peter Ubel presented this one that he's lobbying for what he calls behavioral equipoise, which I find a fascinating concept. The six people who are pretty much not impressed with it, but this is his point. He said, you have a study that concludes that drug B is somewhat better than drug A. Now he says there are some physicians he calls change agents who agree and they start using drug B. But there are some that he calls old fogies who are not convinced and don't use it. So he said, according to the principle of equipoise, to do a follow-up study to convince the old fogies is unethical because clinical equipoise no longer exists. So they are proposing behavioral equipoise, that a trial is potentially justifiable if it addresses behavioral resistance to adequate data. But the critics say that the clinical equipoise involves some uncertainty, that genuine uncertainty exists until most people are convinced. So I'd be interested to hear what study you have that's going to raise this issue, because this is a basic foundational issue to clinical research. And I'd be open to comments. I don't have any answers to any questions necessarily, but your thoughts on this piece.
Whether or not anybody voted that they heard it. So what do you think about that? Is it the reality that's the equipoise, or is it the mindset of the investigators that's equipoise?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the reality is that there's always going to be some uncertainty. And I have two responses to uncertainty, one flippant and one makes sense. The flippant one is life is uncertain. Eat dessert first.
Yeah.
The more logical one... one that was is a quote from a theologian at Fuller Theological Seminary. Says, well, I can remember it now. We cannot get rid of uncertainty. Therefore, we have to be responsible. Now, how does that play out? I'm not entirely sure.
To me, if you look at the iconic therapies that fail, you mentioned two of them. The one that was up when I was a student was SCA to MCA bypass. They were doing these brain bypasses, and everybody did them. And then somebody had the nerve to do a study to compare them. They were no better than doing nothing at all, or possibly even worse. And then you mentioned two other studies, bone marrow transplants for breast cancer and
hormone replacement therapy.
Yeah, replacement therapy.
And how long it's continuing.
There was no equipoise going into those studies. That's a done deal. Mm-hmm. Well, it clearly works. We all use it.
Yep.
And it's unethical to withhold hormone replacement therapy. How can you do something? Things we've done have blown in the face of lack of equipoise.
Mm-hmm.
So
I welcome comments and decline questions. I mean, you're asking exactly the right question. and I don't have a good answer, but I think we need to be aware that this discussion is going on and not be flippant about accepting or rejecting studies and so on.
Well, since equipoise is so hard to achieve, nobody's ever held it as an absolute standard anyway.
True.
So it's all an academic discussion. You know, it's a concept that we strive for, but you know, there's too many shades of gray for it to be either an onerous imposition or a license to just be loosey-goosey.
Yep. Anything else?
This isn't a deep.
It's all right. It's important to know about it.